You're listening to The Rick Smith Show on the Progressive Voices Network.
It's time for The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is The Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Wow, what a day today. What a day today has been. I started off in the morning. I find out of the passing of Representative Elijah Cummings, who, you know, a true American hero, someone that I admired, someone that you have to give credit for, even on his deathbed, signing subpoenas to hold this administration accountable, holding caucus calls to get people united around holding this administration accountable. He will be missed. And, you know, just it started off that was how my day started off. Learning of the 68-year-old congressman who passed. I did not even know he had health care concerns. You know, because you looked at him, you know, as chairman of the House Oversight Committee, I didn't show it. The guy was just an absolute bulldog. And, you know, sad to see his passing. Just terrible thing. Also today, probably just another day in Trumplandia. And to highlight, just that it is another day. New Pew survey out, 54%. 54% of us now approve of the House impeachment inquiry. 52 yesterday, 54 today. Do you see kind of a direction? You know, it keeps going up. The more we learn, the more you know, which is why maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there will be some conscientious Republicans in the Senate. Maybe there will be some people who read the polls and say, look, he's got to go. Today, interesting day. The big, I don't even know which one was bigger, to be honest. But the fact that Mick Mulvaney, the acting White House chief of staff, basically Trump's right-hand man, came out and admitted, yes, there was a quid pro quo. Yes, we did hold the money up, because the facts point that out. I mean, you don't need to be a genius to figure it out. You didn't need Mulvaney to come out and say, yeah, we there was a quid pro quo. You know, look into our political opponent or you don't get the money. Now, he danced around the topic a lot, but ultimately, he admitted it. And he said, look, we do it all the time. Get over it. So, you know, I'm looking at this, and look, everybody else was like, kind of like stunned. And my reaction was, well, this is the Trump MO, isn't it? It's exactly what they do. They get caught. They deny. And then they go, well, so what? You know, everybody does it. No big deal. It's perfectly fine. And then they run away from it, which, again, is what they did today, because almost immediately, and I think it was, you know, I don't know that it was the Jack Nicholson kind of moment of you can't handle the truth, which is, you know, what I, you know, part of me when I saw it was his, you know, he'd just kind of given up. And it went from, you know, we do it all the time, get over it, to, well, you know, the media misconstrued what I was saying. The media didn't understand. The enemy of the state. So, you know, I generally tend to believe what people say first, because that's when they're kind of being most honest. And look, you know, he was being most honest and saying, you know, we do it all the time. Meaning Trump and the administration does it all the time. And look, I don't doubt that. I don't doubt any of this. Also, on the Ukrainian front, the something that didn't get much headlines at all today was the fact that U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Gordon Sondland, testified to close the door hearing before Congress. And Gordon, and look, you know, Gordon's a smart guy. He may not be qualified to do the job, as we talked about yesterday. He may be woefully inept and completely unprepared and unable to do the job, but he's smart enough to know when, uh-oh, I better CYOA. And he's covering his behind because he said, look, he was disappointed that the president directed him to involve Rudy Giuliani. He said it was his view. He said, our view was that the men and women of the State Department, not the president's personal lawyer, should take responsibility for all aspects of U.S. foreign policy towards Ukraine. Generally, isn't that what you think? Why would you bring in somebody who, you know, at this point, you know, would be one of those lawyers, you know, pitching ads at 3 o'clock in the morning? Very little credibility left for poor Rudy. So why would you put him in the middle of that? And even Sondland's going, a little leery. And he said, look, let me state clearly. Inviting a foreign government to undertake investigations for the purpose of influencing an upcoming U.S. election would be wrong. Withholding foreign aid, he said, in order to pressure a foreign government to take steps, such steps would be wrong. I did not and would not ever participate in such undertakings. So you've got him going, oh, you know, it's wrong. It's bad. Not me. While basically, you know, having all of the details saying that's what happened. And of course, Mulvaney's admission today that we do it all the time. Do it all the time. Get over it. So, yeah, there is that. And look, I can't wait for this stuff to just really start coming out public and having these hearings in public so that maybe, you know, the Republicans who still have their heads in the sand will look at this stuff and go, yeah, this isn't right. And this isn't about right or left, Democrat or Republican. This is really about, and I know it's cliche, but it is about right and wrong. This is not how we should be doing business. Now, to say, you know, we pressure foreign countries all the time with money and resources, that's true. We do. We do that. But to say that we pressure foreign governments to investigate our political opponents, that's a bridge too far. And I would think that I would think anyone with a sane, rational thought process, anything banging between the ears, would think that as well. And so not that I have hope that Republicans are sane and rational between the ears, but I'm hopeful, always hopeful. Also today we find out, and this isn't a surprise either. It's another one of those, another day. Evidently, Donald Trump decided that, you know, the best place to hold the G7 summit would be right at his Doral Resort there in Miami. And again, he's going to do it at cost. You know, we're not making any money. And you go, which cost? Off season or peak season? Because you ever look at the back of the hotel doors? I don't know if they still do this, but they used to. On the back of the door, there was like, yeah, the hotel price range would be like $40 to $400. And they got to state that because, you know, during certain times of the year, it could fluctuate. So, you know, this is one of those days where you look at the back of the door. Is he charging the low price or the conventions are in town and they need rooms? Now Mulvaney is saying he doesn't make any money off this stuff. It's just a good place. It won in the competition. And you go, okay, if that's true, how many other G7 summits have been held at Doral? How many other things like this have been at that facility? And I've yet to been able to, you know, to find any of it. Yet to find one. Maybe there isn't. And if you find one for me, by all means, email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com, and I will most certainly correct the record. But as of right now, I haven't seen this. So for me, the first thing that comes to mind is emoluments. This is another moment of him abusing the emoluments clause. This is another moment of him making money off of the office. Because let's say he just did it at cost. Let's say. Think of the wealth of free advertisement that came with that. I mean, because you got to give Trump credit for a couple of things. One, there's nobody more positive that he is right on this planet. There's not. I mean, he absolutely believes that no matter what he does, it's the absolute best possible thing ever, and we're going to have incredible outcomes. I wish I had that kind of thought process. that, yeah, I crashed my car into the telephone pole, but it was the perfect crash. I mean, really just that kind of thinking. And he's always a pitch man. He's always on the con. He's always, you know, he's always, look, he's one of those guys that you shake his hand, make sure you got your rings and your watches when you pull your hand back, because he'll probably take the nails too. But, you know, give him credit for, I guess, that, you know, and maybe hopefully when he's in prison, he'll get people's, you know, extra, you know, Jell-O cup. You know, I don't know. You know, also more as if it couldn't get any worse. Today, Mike Pence announced that there's going to be a ceasefire. Turkey has agreed to a ceasefire in northern Syria to allow the Kurds to vacate their land and go to a safe zone, whatever the hell that means. They're moving them out. So for the next 120 hours, the people have to leave. okay. Now, you know, everyone's saying this is going to be, and Trump himself said this is going to be the greatest thing. We got everything we possibly could have ever wanted, even though I don't know what it is we wanted. And nobody does. And this is probably the part, the most important part. What I find most interesting is, well, first, you've got Mike Pence, you know, talking about how, you know, he prayed for this moment and all the good, you know, prayer people, you know, the millions of people who prayed for this, you know, they're getting what they wanted, which is basically the slaughter of these Kurds. But he also, you know, the ceasefire, which the guy who is the... Yeah, kind of like the foreign defense minister there. He immediately says, it's not a ceasefire. You go, whoa, hold on. You couldn't even get it in the same day that you were on the same message. And this is one of those moments where you go, this is freaking Turkey we're dealing with. This is not a major superpower. We haven't figured out how to do diplomacy with really, you know, a minor player. What's going to happen when finally, you know, now Mitt Romney, Romney called the deal a bloodstain on U.S. history. He, in his discussion today on the Senate floor, asked the question, are we so weak and inept diplomatically that Turkey forced the hand of the United States of America? Turkey, he says. I believe that it's imperative that public hearings are held to answer these questions, and I hope the Senate will be able to conduct these hearings. Today, you may remember, yesterday you had the House, which voted, you know, overwhelmingly. I mean, it was an enormous, it was a bipartisan vote of just enormous. I think it was, 354 to 60 with four people not voting. 354 people in the U.S. House of Representatives in 2019 voted for something. I mean, think about the magnitude that you could get that many people in the U.S. House of Representatives to agree on a piece of legislation that you know, the president was moving on. I mean, it's incredible. And then what you got today in the Senate, the House, the Republicans blocked the resolution. And, of course, it was a lot of the same actors. It was the Rand Pauls and the Billies and all of them. Because, you know, look, you got the anti-war part, which I kind of agree with. But oddly enough, Mitch McConnell was against the resolution because it wasn't strong enough. It didn't rebuke the president's policy enough. And I thought that interesting. But Romney got the most press of the day because, you know, Romney was pretty harsh on them, as he should be. And this is a world where you go, Mitt Romney's now... the guy who's fighting for some bit of what's left of our Constitution? Really? Mitt Romney? That's the best hope we've got? Anyway, he said the announcement today is being portrayed as a victory. It's far from a victory. Serious questions remain about how the decision was reached precipitously to withdraw from Syria and why that decision was reached. And that's one of those things that, you know, from the beginning I've been asking, you know, why now? Why this? What got between Trump's ears that made him just go, you know, screw it, everybody out? You know, because it seemed that quick. I don't know that there was I don't think there was a story on Fox News. Maybe there could have been. Any of my Fox viewers, if there was, I'd love to see what that was. But, you know, what is it about this issue that now Trump's going, screw it, we're leaving. And look, I don't want any U.S. soldiers harmed, but the fact that there was just a presence there was why Turkey didn't do anything, even if you had one guy there. But here again, this is another one of those issues where we're diplomatically, I believe, being outmaneuvered. And you know behind the scenes, it's Putin and the Russians pulling the strings. And this is not a good thing. Now, what's interesting is Donald Trump, again, you got to give him credit. You got to give Trump credit again for the power of positive thinking. He said he wanted to thank and congratulate President Erdogan and called him a friend. Said he's a friend of mine. So again, you look at this and you go, who are this guy's friends? You know, you look at Duarte, you look at Kim Jong-un, you look at Vlad, and now, really? Really? Interesting timing. But lots to get to today, lots to talk about. There's even so much more that didn't get into my opening. We will most certainly get to. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, and talk a little bit about what happened at the Dem debates and bang around some of the other good news today. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show. More American than workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win.
On The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1932. That was the day the state militia was called into Kincaid, Illinois. 164 high school students had just walked out of the classroom, declaring themselves on strike. They were protesting the school board's use of coal from the Peabody Coal Company. The students walked out in solidarity with their fathers, who were on strike against the Peabody coal mine in nearby Langleyville over wage concessions. The father-son strike, as it was referred to, was one more in a series of protest actions that came on the heels of the founding of the Progressive Miners of America a month earlier. Thousands of Illinois miners had just voted with their feet to repudiate John L. Lewis's UMWA over wage concessions. After their founding conference, new PMA leaders began aggressively organizing non-union mines. They marched into mining towns and ordered non-union diggers out of the mines. They also struck UMWA mines picketing against the industry standard of $5 a day that had been set by the latest concessionary contract. At some mines, the PMA was able to win the old $6.10 a day wage. Throughout the month, the State National Guard had been called out to a number of mining towns to quell armed conflicts between PMA and UMWA supporters. The Peabody coal mine in Langleyville had been shut down for months by ongoing PMA-UMWA conflict. Now it had reopened under heavy National Guard protection and was the only mine operating in Christian County. The striking fathers were PMA miners picketing the continued mine operations under the UMWA concessionary contract. The years-long Illinois mine wars had just begun.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So another fun day in Trumplandia. I forgot to mention that Rick Perry has gotten himself in the middle of all this. And one of the people they call the Three Amigos of Ukraine, he has, I guess, now officially tendered his resignation. And I don't know if this is, he's going to go, he's not going to go, because it's been this cat and mouse game with Perry for a while. He's in, he's out, he's out, he's in. I guess now finally has given it. Last report I saw said he had planned on staying through Thanksgiving. Who knows? Maybe you know, you get Thanksgiving pay. Maybe that's the whole reason he gets the day's pay. I don't know. But, you know, I've only got the one thing to say to him. Good. Bye. So there is that. Although, honestly, you could end up with someone much, much worse. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the big Democratic debate of the other night and why, again, anyone on that stage, and I would argue probably anybody in the entire auditorium would be better than the guy we've sitting in the White House right now. I've asked Rick Neal to come talk with us. Rick is a former Ohio congressional candidate and healthcare activist. Rick, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it's great to be here. Thank you very much.
So, you know, I'm looking at this, the day of news, and you go, virtually anybody in that auditorium, I'm expanding it to not just the people on the stage. You know, maybe the janitor, the person who screwed in the light bulbs, any of those people I think would be more functional than the guy we've got now.
Well, at least the janitor would know what people need, right?
Yeah, good point.
It was a really interesting experience. So I was there in the hall. Like you said, I ran for Congress last year and just got to know a lot of the Dems and, had a really, frankly, great experience running in such a terrific district. It was, it covered a good swath of South Central Ohio. And so it was good to be there. It was a long evening, and you really got to wonder how the candidates stuck it out up there. But the thing that was really clear to me was that it was very much a made-for-TV kind of event, right? I've watched them in the past on the TV, and they're kind of entertaining, right? They shoot, and you can look at your phone, and you can get up and, go do whatever you need to. But being there in the hall, it's clear how, how quickly it moves, how you don't really get into a lot of the topics. And I got to tell you, the thing that made it really clear that it was made for TV is that they didn't talk about stuff that really worries, or is on the mind of a lot of people. Not a lot of conversation about jobs and wages.
Nothing on energy or climate or any of that either.
Well, the climate thing too, yeah, was really remarkable. And even on healthcare, just talking a lot about Medicare for All and coverage. And I think the real concerns about costs, which is what's bothering a lot of people, didn't get enough attention.
Yeah, but how can you have enough attention on any issue when you get 75 seconds? I mean, you can't have any real substantive discussion in 75 seconds.
Yeah, right. I mean, then that's what I mean. So that's what I mean. So made for TV, right? And I guess, that's what's going on. It's a lot of the activists, real political nerds who are tuning in at this point. But, it is a pretty important process. I mean, we got to figure out who our nominee is going to be.
Right.
And so, hopefully people will be taking a look at other things and not just these debates.
Yeah. So have you chosen a candidate yet? I mean, most of the people I talk to are kind of like, well, we're going to wait to see how it plays. I'm one of those. I'm one of the people, I'm leaning towards Elizabeth Warren. I'm a big Bernie Sanders fan. I like Joe Biden as a person. I don't know. I mean, have you chosen yet?
Yeah, I have. And it's Joe Biden. And,
okay.
And where that came from, for a lot of us here in Ohio, we were really excited about Sherrod Brown, and we really had our fingers crossed that he was going to get in. And when he didn't, then, it took me a little bit to try to figure out what was going on. But when Joe Biden came out with that announcement video, I lived overseas for a long time. I worked with refugees in Asia and Africa. I saw what happens when American leadership falls apart. And I feel like, when Biden's talking about that, it really speaks to me.
Yeah.
And I just really appreciate that.
Yeah, and looking at what this administration is doing today, I mean, this whole thing in Syria with Turkey is just mind-numbing. I mean, I don't know how you stand on a stage and call something a ceasefire, and then the person you made the agreement with saying, no, it's not a ceasefire. No, it's not that. I don't know how you do that.
Well, right. I mean, and it just goes to show that what they're doing is the nice thing to call it is spin, but what it really is, it's just a bunch of BS. I mean, they're just gaslighting us again to try to get us to stop talking about it. They're like, oh, look, the vice president's in Turkey, they have a ceasefire. Great, we're done. But I mean, it's incredible that what they're doing is just sanctioning what the Turks are doing, invading this country and pushing 2 million Kurds out of their homes. I mean, this is exactly the kind of situation that I used to deal with, right, when I was in the field. And it's appalling. It's shocking.
Yeah, but again, this is another one of those moments where, I don't know that in my lifetime it's been, this apparent that we've abandoned people who we at one point called an ally. I mean, we've done it, I'm certain, but never in this way, I don't think.
And it was only 2 weeks ago, less, right?
Yeah, it seems like a year ago. It was only 2 weeks?
Right? Yeah. No, it's been such a short period of time. And these are, they're real consequences. I mean, this is not just a game. The consequences for communities there, people being killed by the Turks and their allies, and their people having to flee their home, abandon their homes. It takes a lot for people to give up everything that they've had.
Yeah.
And just throw up their hands and give themselves over to their fate and try to move and find some place of safety. And that's what we're doing. So the end of betrayal then, you know, as we've been hearing those reports, is just unbelievably hard for our troops. It's incredible. It's dishonorable. It's disrespectful. It's just a travesty.
Now, I remember after 9/11, you had all the people going, you know, why do they hate us so much? You know, why do the people in the Middle East, you go, this?
Well, right. Yeah. And just, I mean, and Iraq was its own thing, right? I mean, the lies and the disinformation that our own government was spreading. But I mean, this is crazy. This is just, the president just going nuts. And I mean, I think it was building up, right? Like, I was listening to some stuff that was saying, you know, Turkey's definitely been signaling that they want to do this. And I think the president has definitely been hearing that, but just to go off like that, you know, from one second to the next and have, no process to deal with it is criminal.
Yeah. Well, you know, he's a non-conventional president.
Yeah. That's one way of putting it. Yeah, he does, you know, and it's interesting when you think about it, the three things that we got going on, you know, Ukraine and Turkey, and then, like you were talking about earlier, what's going on with the G7 in Miami. I can't even pronounce the thing, Doral,
yeah.
Is that it? You know, Ukraine is betrayal, and Turkey is surrender to the Russians, and Doral is corruption.
It's theft, yeah, absolutely.
And that's what this is about.
No, I mean, you know, and again, I'm not a very bright guy. You know, I'm not the smartest guy in the world. I don't have a crystal ball. I'm not clairvoyant. But on Inauguration Day, I said, get ready for it. This is going to be the most kleptocratic administration in the history of our country. And they have not disappointed.
No, you were right on. You're right on. It's crazy. And for them to have, you know, just blowing smoke and talking about talking about Joe Biden, you know, remaining son. As corrupt, and it's them all. It's, you know, it's them in spades. It's just it's gross.
Yeah, I mean, given the fact that the Trump kids have been making money all over the world, I don't know how you with a straight face point that finger. My mother always said, you know, when you point your finger at somebody, you got three pointing back at you.
Right.
You know, there aren't enough fingers on the hand to point back at Trump.
No, they're shameless, and they they don't care. I mean, I think they very much feel like they're above the law. You know, that they're in power, and so that means they must deserve it.
Yeah, but you know, as a Biden guy, I mean, you have to be fairly happy about yesterday. He finally, you know, I don't know that he's run so far the greatest campaign. He's done all right. But he came out with a video yesterday, you know, and a tweet that went with it, you know, saying, hey, you want to talk about corruption? He said, I've released 21 years of my tax returns. Release yours or shut up. And I thought that was pretty good. Do it or shut up.
I know, and it's clear and it's strong, and it's kind of what we're all thinking, right? But there's so much noise, so it's nice to see someone break through it. You know what? I thought he did the same thing that weekend when, like a month ago now, when the whole Ukraine thing broke, right? And reporters started to, he was at that steak fry thing in Iowa, and, you know, all the candidates were there, and reporters were getting in his face about it. And he just turned right at him, and he said, he called him out, and he said, no, that's not, this, you know, this is not what the story is. They're trying, you know, they're trying to fool us again. That is not the story. The story is his own corruption.
Right.
So I felt like he showed what it would be like to stand up to Trump. Like,
yeah, but ultimately, you know, he's going to need a lot more energy come general election time. Because look, you know, one of the knocks against him is he's not, you know, he doesn't seem to me to be the Joe Biden that I remember. He seems to have maybe lost a step, and I don't know if that's he's playing cautious. I'm not quite sure what the game plan is. But,
I would have, you know, sorry, go ahead.
But he's going to have to step it up one way or another.
Yeah, I agree. You know, it's interesting. His campaign manager is a great guy who's from here. He's from Cleveland. He spent a lot of time here in Columbus, and you know, they were all around during the debate here in Columbus, and it was great hearing him talk about you know, about their plan and just about how they're really focused on those early states and they're not taking anything for granted. You know, it's interesting that you talked about Biden being cautious. You know, you know, what you hear a lot here is that, of course, people are scared out of their minds, right? I mean, even business people who try to keep their cool, they're like, you know, what's going on? You know, they'll ask me because they think I know, right? But, you know, people are, it's worrying, right? Like, just to see the president just being a whack job and everything else that's going on. And so, you know, there Biden is, and I think that he might be favoring just being, trying to be cool, trying to be calm, just trying to show people that, you know, the grown-ups are coming and that things are going to be okay.
Yeah, kind of hearkening back to the Obama years, which I'll be honest with you, I voted for Barack Obama twice. My problem is, I thought he could have been a better. I thought he could have done more. I thought he could have been a better president, especially early on. And that's one of my fears about Joe Biden, is that we're gonna expect a lot and get very little. And I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah, it's interesting. I thought that I was wondering how he was going to do it. Like, are they just going to rest on their laurels, or like, especially when you had a lot of candidates out there really, pushing a lot of big ideas. And I thought, what's he going to do? And then, as I dug into it, read his healthcare plan and read his rural plan and listened to his foreign policy speech. And what I've been impressed with is that it seems like they're, taking what the Obama administration did and pushing it out. I feel like that there is quite a bit of progress in those plans. So, we'll see. Hopefully.
No, because healthcare
we'll
seems
get a chance to see how it's going to work.
Right. Because healthcare seems to be one of those areas where, they're really picking at, because I think right now, it's really going to be between Sanders, Warren, Biden, and maybe a fourth, but I'm not seeing it. I'm seeing those. That's going to be where it's going to boil down to. And healthcare seems to be where, Warren and Sanders have one idea and Biden on the other side. So the conversation can come down to healthcare, I think.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think it's a really clear, contrast between them. I love it. I love that the public option that was so scary, right? Like, back in 2008 and 2009 is now the one thing that everybody can agree on, right? And I love that. I think for places like Ohio, Sherrod Brown ran and won really convincingly here last year. And one of the things that big idea that he had that I also talked about in my race was, expanding Medicare to cover everyone from 55 and up.
Right.
And that's
it's a good first step.
Idea. What's that?
It's a good first step. I mean, it's incrementally getting us to Medicare for all. And I was just telling somebody about this last night. I said, do you know how many people because I was talking to a guy at work, and I said, do you know how many people would leave this place tomorrow if healthcare, you could sign on to Medicare at 55? This place would empty out almost immediately.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. Yeah.
No, I mean, because to me, that's you want to get younger people jobs, get us old timers out of the game.
I see what you're talking about. Yeah, that's a good point. And it just, it gives people some more choice too. I mean, it's a little bit hard, and there's a lot of places, where there's not a lot of choice in health insurance. And so the insurance companies, can do what they want.
Yeah.
And so I think having a public option and especially that idea about 55 and up would be really helpful.
Well, let me ask you this, Rick. I mean, is choice all that important in insurance companies? I mean, really, honestly and truthfully, is choice what you're looking for in insurance? Or are you looking for when you're sick, you see a doctor? When you fall and break both your knees in the courtyard, you get casts? Figure out which is more important.
Yeah. Well, I think in terms of choice, in terms of what you're paying, right? So, I mean, if there's only one insurance company, that's going to cover you, well, then they can pretty much do what they want. So I think, when it comes down to choice, it just comes down to having people compete over you as a customer.
And also how much you're willing to take risk on your own, because that's basically what they do. Well, I love this argument, too. Only get what you need.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to decide, well, I'm prone to maybe a heart attack, so I'll take heart attack coverage, but I'll give up the cancer coverage.
Right, right, because I know exactly what's going to happen. Yeah, no, I mean, obviously, the system isn't working. I really appreciate that Sanders reminds us that we pay so much as a nation for healthcare. And I studied this as a public health student. We spend a ridiculous amount of percentage of our GDP for healthcare, and our outcomes aren't as good, as other places. So, it's pretty clear that it's not working.
Yeah, I mean, to me, their costs shouldn't go up. We should just be allocating the resources that we're already putting into it in a much better fashion. And because right now what we're doing is we're still rationing care. I mean, I hear people say, well, if we go to a single payer, they're going to ration care. You go, hey, dumb. They're already rationing care.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, in going back to the debate, was there anything there that, because I'll tell you, my take on it was, it's kind of like deja vu. I've seen this movie. Anything in there that jump out at you? You go, hey, this was different?
No, I mean, my gosh, pretty soon after it started, that Buttigieg and then Klobuchar both went after Warren. Excuse me. That was surprising, and it was pretty dramatic in the hall, right? Like you noticed it, and it was, you know, and Biden just sort of had to step back and be quiet.
Yeah, no. Hey, let somebody else take the arrows for a change.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and they were kind of doing his job for him, frankly. So that was a remarkable moment for sure. Lots of fireworks from some of the other folks on the stage, but you know, I was really there to hear what the front runners had to say. Yeah. I wanted to hear from Biden and Warren. I appreciated what Kamala Harris had to say. I was, and I think a lot of people were impressed with Amy Klobuchar. It was interesting seeing her and listening to her in person, right?
Yeah, she's a radical
and that
centrist.
Made a difference. Yeah, yeah. So. And a lot of people liked Mayor Pete, but I especially appreciated Biden's closing statement. I just thought he was really strong, and I think he gets. I do think he gets what's going on with Trump and is able to kind of cut through the noise and cut through the crap and see what we need to do.
Well, at the end of the day, to me at this point, and I know people have chosen their camps, and my person doesn't win. It doesn't matter to me who wins the primary. Like I said,
absolutely.
If it's the janitor, bring the mop. You know, we got to clean, not just drain the swamp, but actually scrub it out.
Right. Right. And that's the thing, too, that, you know, is nice about as I, you know, talk to people here and connect with people. And I always say, you know, because they're for Warren or for Mayor Pete. I mean, my gosh, I'm married to a guy and my husband's all in for Pete right now. Right. And, you know, but we're all going to be working together at the end. And we all know that.
So that's interesting. So, I mean, so, you know, the gay vote doesn't automatically go to Mayor Pete.
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, because one of the knocks that I've heard about Joe Biden, and obviously you probably could speak to this better than I can, but, you know, his whole support for Don't Ask, Don't Tell and all that stuff, you know, during those years, you don't hold that against him?
No, not at all. I mean, you know, Joe, I think Biden got a jump start on marriage equality with that interview that he did back, when was that? in 2012. And the president, you know, came out and endorsed marriage equality a few days later. Biden came here and spoke to the annual dinner of the Human Rights Campaign, which is the national LGBTQ advocacy group. And he knocked it out of the park. He for the first time, I got to tell you something real quick. It was the first time I had heard a national figure like himself, a national politician, come to one of our events and not just, you know, congratulate us for working hard and, you know, getting marriage equality and standing up for ourselves. But he said he recognized that what we had done was good for the country as a whole, that we had moved freedom forward. And I had never heard a national figure say that. And I really, that really said something to me.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the whole idea of, you know, equality and, you know, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, you know, that, you know, those flowery words that I think I've read somewhere before.
Yeah, I mean, it's meaningful, and that, you know, and it's nice to see it in someone like Biden, who I think also has strong connections with labor and understands why standing up for workers is so important.
Yeah.
And on civil rights, you know, I think he gets it. In terms of that, we're all of our individual, all of our community victories, all of our little victories are really, add up to a greater whole, where we're where the country benefits, the country moves forward as a whole.
Yeah, well, look, at the end of the day, if he's the nominee, I don't have a problem voting for him. But like I said, at this point, bring on the janitor.
Right. Right, I know.
So, last question I got for you. You know, 2020 is around the corner. We run it again. Is that in the cards?
Thanks for asking. So, I am really, really focused right now on beating Donald Trump and getting him out of the White House. and I really enjoyed running. I don't think that there's, I think that it's more important for me to focus on getting Donald Trump out. If, you know, frankly, if something crazy were to happen and the seat were suddenly open, I'm ready to go.
Right.
I think about campaigning all the time. I think about what I would do different. It was a great race. I really enjoyed it, but we got to get Trump out.
Yeah, when I talk to people who are going to be candidates, they say if you're going to run once, you got to commit to three times.
Yeah.
The first time you learn all the lessons and all the stuff you didn't know, you take all the lumps and all the beatings and you make all the mistakes. The second time around, you kind of got an idea, you figure it out, you tweak some stuff, you move forward. And the third time, you better be a well-oiled machine. And if you don't win the third time, that's when you give it up.
Right. Well, yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to staying involved. I am worried about 2020, though, Rick, I got to tell you.
I am, too.
It's
Look,
very,
I've,
very tough.
I've already predicted I think he's going to win. Look, I grew up in Cleveland, and I tell people when I predicted Trump was going to win in April of 2016, I went back home to my family, and they were all voting for him. Mm. And that was scary for me.
What do they say now?
They're not paying attention. You know, they're not political people. They're not involved. They never have been. But they heard the message that they're going to recreate. And he's bringing back the good old days. You know, these are all working class folks who lost jobs and all the factories that had moved out. They lived through deindustrialization and they're struggling, you know, like everybody else. And so the message of, hey, we're going to bring back those union jobs. We're going to bring back those good wages. And, oh, by the way, we're going to go punish those, you know, those black and brown people and all those other folks. That resonated, too. But more importantly, it was about economics.
Yeah. Yeah.
They just didn't believe Hillary Clinton, and they also hated her. And most of that was because of Bill. But there is that. But, Rick, I appreciate the time. Really great talking with you. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Oh, Rick, anytime. Thank you for doing the show. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Terrific. Thanks so much. Rick Neal, former Ohio congressional candidate. You can follow him on Twitter at Rick_Neal. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1987. That was the day that more than 100,000 people gathered in Paris to stand up against poverty and hunger. The gathering was inspired by Father Joseph Racinski, a French Catholic priest. He founded the All Together in Dignity Fourth World Movement, dedicated to addressing poverty. That day unveiled a commemorative stone to honor the victims of extreme poverty. The stone bears an image of two people, arms outstretched, releasing a bird into the sky. The stone's inscription read, "On this day, defenders of human and civil rights from every continent gathered here. They paid homage to the victims of hunger, ignorance, and violence. They affirmed their conviction that human misery is not inevitable. They pledged their solidarity with all people who, throughout the world, strive to end extreme poverty." The site they chose to place the stone was significant. The Trocadero Plaza in Paris is where the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was proclaimed by the United Nations in 1948. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights affirmed the basic rights of all people, including the right to form and to join trade unions, and the right to equal pay for equal work. Placing the commemorative stone at this important spot was a continuation of this legacy. In the years since then, on this very day, other cities around the world have commemorated replicas of the stone. Nearly 20 cities in France have dedicated stones. Cities in Canada, Mexico, Switzerland, Belgium, Ireland, Scotland, Great Britain, Italy, Poland, Portugal, and the Philippines have all placed these tributes. In 1992, the United Nations declared today, October 17th, the annual International Day for the Eradication of Poverty.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So some potentially good news today out of all of the chaos around the Trump administration and all of the insanity there. Some potentially good news for the UAW members. And we're going to find out when they have their ratification vote. We find out that the strike is going to last until, as I understand, October 25th. Where the members can vote on what's been presented. And from initially when I looked at it, I'm going, well, it's not bad. A little bit of a wage increase, moving the temporary permanent employees to permanent, some better pathways there. But still, when the devil's in the details, and here to share some thoughts on the announcement today, and maybe what we're finding out and what we know. I've asked Frank Hammer to come talk with us. Frank is a retired UAW member and former UAW local president, someone who actually did some negotiating like they're doing right now. Frank, thanks for taking time for us.
Glad to do it, Rick. Thank you very much.
So let me give me your gut reaction. What do you think?
So the agreement is designed for a ratification. And when I say that, I mean that there's a lot of cash in it.
Right.
So, you know, workers are going to be looking at the what they call the legacy workers and
right.
the in progression. They're going to be looking at this $11,000 bonus.
Yeah, I can make back all the money I missed while I was on strike.
Yeah. And, you know, they have half that amount to, I believe it is, the temporary workers. They're going to get a signing bonus. So I think up front, in terms of the cash that is going out there with the agreement, is designed to get a ratification, considering that people will already have been out on strike 31 days. And by the time the ratification vote is completed, which I think is October 26th, there'll be another full week of out on the picket line. So that's pretty clear. And then there's also provisions for buyouts and with bonuses of $60,000 for the buyouts.
Wow.
So that means that, you know, there'll be the legacy workers will have an opportunity to, you know, retire and take buyouts or take buyouts and leave their employment with GM, and that'll enable GM to hire lower paid workers. That's, you know, there's a win-win in that situation for both parties. So there's a lot of that. And but I think what it really represents to me is that it's really writing into stone the employment arrangements that henceforth is going to be the template for work and the future of work in the U.S. and including the maintenance of long-term temporary employees, the continued stratification of the workforce. Even though I noticed that over the life of the agreement, that the in progression and legacy workers will finally, at the end of the 4 years, be making the same rate of pay.
Right.
Which is, you know, that's a new development that it will be done within the 4 years. However, if you learn, for example, that even though they're going to be getting the same wage rate, the in progression workers don't get a pension like the legacy workers. And the in progression workers will not have health care when they retire. And that's just, there's all these ways that the workforce is being differentiated, and certain people will get certain things and other workers won't. That structure is now, if this, with a ratification of this agreement, will be carved in stone.
Right.
And
No, you're right. And those are huge things that nobody seemed to pick up on.
Well, you know, I can tell you that the temps picked up on it for sure. Certainly, the in progression workers picked on it for sure. I mean, and I have to say,
as I'm reading through the media reports, you know,
this is
the first I'm hearing of that. This is the first I'm hearing that wasn't addressed.
Okay, now I got it. And I've unfortunately been very active and very busy for the day, and I haven't got a chance to really review what the media is putting out. So. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very, very critical. People really need to understand that by if there's a ratification of this agreement, they are going to etch in the stone the pattern across the U.S., and we know that it's already a pattern in many, many places, but this is a union work environment, and they will really inscribe it in stone that this is the way it's going to be going forward.
No, that's terrible. But, you know, but as you've pointed out, this already is the pattern for American workers. The fact that you would get any type of health care in retirement, that's been something that's been long gone from most workplaces.
Well, it's with us in GM, and that was not changed in this agreement. And you know, so for example, you know, and again, you know, so the line was held on the legacy workers, and I have to say, you know, that's a good thing and a bad thing, because it is true that more of the monies in the agreement are being relegated to the progression and to maybe even the temps, I'm not sure. But there is more being done to raise the bottom. But what it means for legacy workers is that they're still eligible. They have a pension. They will retire with a pension. But nothing was done with improving that pension, which is a characteristic of previous agreements, that they always made improvements on something called a pension, and they held a line on that, and instead they're going to put, the company's going to put $1,000 in every one of the legacy workers' 401k, and that's it. And that's another, you know, that's a fairly big admission that, you know, pensions are going the way of, you know, other things that we've traditionally held to be dear in the UAW.
Yeah, no, and it's, you know, to have the UAW, you know, you're the last one. Once this goes away, once you're like the last dinosaur. I mean, it's over then.
Yeah. Yeah. And this codifies it again.
Yeah. So what do you think the chances of this contract then being ratified? Because we haven't even talked about the other things, you know, the plant closures. We haven't talked about, you know, any of the bringing jobs back from Mexico. We haven't talked about, you know, a whole bunch of things yet that were front and center. You've just pointed out that, you know, it's there's some money here. Also, uncapping the profit sharing, you know, makes people go, hey, there's more money in this.
Yes, I confess I don't know the significance of, you know, how much more that will mean, but yeah, in terms of there is a lot of, you know, there's bling in the agreement. I mean, people will see that you know, they're going to be able to recoup some cash. I mean, I think the thing that you brought up about the plants, the four plants that in the U.S. that GM last November announced they intended to you know, they were unallocated and intended to close. Certainly, the folks at Detroit Hamtramck Assembly can feel tentatively pleased that they're talking about future work, but it's really rather vague about, you know, they talked about electric truck, but we'll see what comes of that. Certainly, the big losers in this, and it must be the most frustrated UAW GM members, are the ones in Lordstown, who, despite all the talk to the contrary, can read in the summary that the Lordstown plant will close and will remain closed, is what I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, to be honest, I didn't see them ever reopening that. You know, just because, you know, they at a time they did that. I just go, you know, it just seems like now this is the end of it.
I agree, but I think what they were doing, and, you know, it came from GM. Oh, well, maybe we'll build a battery plant next door or something like that. But there's really no mention of that in the highlights. And of course, you know, my plant, you know, is one of the ones that's going to remain. It'll finally close. There's only seven workers left, and a few contractors, I should add. So, you know, I mean, I think that the problem with that is that it was never an issue. The closure of my plant was never an issue. It was never an issue. And, you know, it's true that in the last years of its life, it only had, like, you know, 300, 400, maybe 500 workers at the max, compared to when we had 3,500. But nevertheless, you know, we had this big hulk of metal, you know, sitting in Warren, and it's what's going to become of it, and what's the impact on the erosion of, you know, the city of Warren's tax base, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, at least some really big questions about the responsibility that General Motors has to these communities. You know, Warren gave GM all kinds of tax abatements. The state of Michigan gave GM's tax abatements and tax credits. So what becomes of all that, and what becomes of GM's responsibility? And the contract doesn't specify any responsibility at all, other than, I should add, other than they do have a incentivized buyout for workers from those plants. So you can get a $75,000 bonus on the way out the door if you're, you know, retired, if you were still working as of October 2018, I believe it was. So that's the only thing that they threw to the workers who remain there and who are now no longer going to be employed in those plants.
Yeah, threw them a quick bone. So in looking at this and weighing what we've seen, because, look, all of this is a negotiation. You're never going to get everything that you want. You know, do you think this goes through? I mean, do you think that, you know, the workforce goes, hey, we've been out, you know, 30 some days. It's worth staying out longer to see if we can get better, or, you know, cut the loss and go back. How are you seeing this playing out?
Well, the most vocal workers are the ones who are really disappointed in the agreement. And I'm assuming there's a large body of workers who are not necessarily, you know, going out on Facebook and giving their feelings about the contract. But I know that I suspect that the long, it's been an amazing strike. I mean, the fact that we've had this long of a strike at General Motors, and, you know, that's going to be weighing on people. It's going to be certainly weighing on the workers in the lower tier. It's certainly going to be weighing on the temps. So I think it's going to be a hard one to call. And I think that, I would not be surprised if people, would accept this agreement because they're afraid that further hardship isn't going to, the negotiators are going to basically say, well, this is the best we could do for you. So, you know, you might as well accept it instead of going back out on strike, you know, and losing more money. I have a feeling that's how it's going to get sold.
Yeah, but here's the thing. I mean, they're not going back out on strike. They're still on strike. I mean, it goes through the 25th.
Yes.
When all this is going to continue.
It will continue.
So let me ask you, you know, as someone who's done this for a while, is there a way that we would say, look, the membership turns it down and the UAW says this is the best we can get and it's imposed? Is that something that's possible?
So I've seen different outcomes. You know, like in 2015, when the Chrysler workers rejected the national agreement, which was the first in my career that I saw that happen, it was to the UAW's credit, the negotiators went back in and actually came back with a slightly improved contract, and they got ratified. I have also seen the alternative. I mean, decades ago, a contract was imposed after it was rejected. So I don't rule that out.
Right.
I don't rule that out at all. I could well see the leadership wanting to impose the agreement. On the other hand, they might have rebellion in their hands because the leadership, unfortunately, doesn't have the kind of credibility that it might have had, you know, two, three decades ago.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see how this plays out, and it'll be interesting how it plays out and what the vote will end up eventually being. But I'm hopeful that, because look, I saw this and they go, hey, you know, they got a nice little raise. There's some good money in this. The initial responses looked pretty good. And I'm going, hey, this is a good thing. This is, and then immediately I just got hammered for people going, no, it's crap. It's terrible. It's bad. And I'm going, you know, tell me why. You know, from what I'm seeing, it looks okay. And then they started pointing out, hey, there's this, there's that. And I'm going, oh, you're right. This is there's still some work to be done.
Yeah, so, I mean, just to be clear, you know, I think there's an anticipation among the rank and file that some of the concessions that were given up would be back in the agreement. For example, time and a half for overtime after 8 hours. We used to have that. That was disappeared. Wow. It hasn't come back. The cost, we used to have a cost of living allowance. In fact, we had a very, very long strike to win back the cost of living allowance decades ago. And that was also conceded back, and we no longer have that. That's not in this agreement. So there's a lot of omissions.
Yeah, so there's still more. There's more stuff to get into. And as it happens, I'd love to hear more. I hope you'll come back and keep us up to date. I appreciate it, Frank.
I appreciate your interest again. Thank you so
Thanks
much,
so Rick. Much. Thanks so much, Frank Hammer. Quick break. Right back.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.